For this series, we are taking up studies in the life of Moses. And tonight, more or less, will be an introductory address based on Exodus chapter 1. Reading, please, from verse 1. Now, these are the names of the sons of Israel. Notice the change, please. These are the names of the sons of Israel which came into Egypt. Verse 6, and Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. The children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now, there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply and it come to pass that, when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us and so get them up out of the land. Therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Rameses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, and in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. The king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah, and he said, If it be a son, then ye shall kill him, but if it be a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. The king of Egypt called for the midwives, and said unto them, Why have ye done this thing, and have saved the men children alive. Verse 20, Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. It came to pass because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, Every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save. A lie. Thus we have read the background to Moses' birth and life. Just keep your Bible handy, won't you? The book of Genesis has to do with beginnings and doctrinally teaches the truth of election. That is quite clearly seen. It is constantly the choice of God. So it was that away back at the beginning, God chose Shem, one of the three sons of Noah, that ultimately from him there came the nation of Israel. Then coming a little closer, you will recall that God chose Abraham, one of three sons, who would become the father of the faithful. Then you will remember that God set aside Ishmael and chose Isaac. Yet again he set aside Esau the firstborn and he chose Jacob. Yet again he set aside Reuben the eldest of the 12 sons and chose Joseph. So that right throughout the book of Genesis you are impressed with the sovereignty of God. The election of God. When you come to the book of Exodus, it has to do historically with the exodus of Israel out of Egypt, but doctrinally, it teaches redemption. And time and again, you have heard the preacher on Egypt as a type of the world, Pharaoh as a type of Satan, and the great work of God to bring Israel out of Egypt, redeemed by blood of the Lamb, and redeemed by power at the Red Sea. But of course, you will appreciate, as I indicated when I read verse 1, now these are the sons of Israel, that there is an aspect in which you find the sons of Israel in bondage in Egypt. And of course, we are going to see later, I don't know whether you've been taught these things or not, we'll come to that in a moment. We're going to see later that Egypt, along with other places, is typical of the world system that surrounds us. But more about that later. Now, you will notice that the book opens with this expression, the sons of Israel, drawing attention to their dignity as the people of God. Now, let me bring it over a moment into your New Testament. Now, I want you to appreciate tonight that sonship is the greatest blessing of the present day. There is nothing greater or higher or more wonderful than the fact that you are a son of God. Now, because there is an allied truth connected with that, would you please turn over to your New Testament to Galatians chapter 4. Let me point out one or two things to you. Galatians chapter 4. In this instance, you're as well to turn to it, that by reading it, you might learn certain fundamental truths. Galatians 4 at verse 4. When the fullness of the time was come. Now, that's a point in the divine calendar. A moment when it pleased divine wisdom to intervene in the affairs of men. There had been a fullness reached. That is, the revelation of God had come forward to a certain point. And when that point had been reached, therefore, God sent forth His Son. Wonderful moment, wasn't it? I spoke to you about it at the conference when I dealt with the truth of the virgin birth. Now, read on. Me, born, come of a woman. That's the virgin birth. He was born of a woman. He wasn't born of him. Do you remember I told you that God brought in Adam without the agency of male or female? He brought Eve in without the agency of a female. You and I enter this world through the agency of male and female father and mother, our parents. But he entered into the world when he came in, God used the agency of a woman, but not a man. So he was born of a woman that, notice, he is the son of God. God sent his son. Secondly, he's a real man. He's born of a woman. Thirdly, look now, born under the law. So he's born a Jew, subject to the authority of the Jewish law, and he will maintain the righteousness of that law throughout his life. Now, notice now the reason for this. To redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. That we might receive the position of sons, not children. Now listen carefully. As a child, as children, we are born into the family of God. But as sons, we are placed in the position. Adoption indicates that you have a place that naturally you're not entitled to. Got the idea? So that you're born by new birth into the family of God, but you are placed by God as a son before Him. You've no right to that position. None at all. God adopted you. It is really son-placing. So that, notice, the moment that you were saved, you were a son of God. You maybe didn't know it like the preacher. But that's who you were. Look again. verse 6, and because ye are sons, God hath sent forth the Spirit of His Son into your heart, crying, Abba, Father. So the moment that you were saved, you were a son of God, and that same moment you received the Spirit of God. Now you grasp that. Now let it simmer. That will save you from Pentecostal error. You receive the Spirit at conversion. This is not the only basic text that teaches this. Now if you young people can get these things in, you'll be saved from a great deal of what's going abroad. Got that? So that you are a son of God. Now I don't know how much you appreciate it. For instance, if somebody met you someday and they said, excuse me, but living around here or working with you, I noticed that you're different from other people. Would you mind telling me, what are you? Come on now. What would you say? You would likely say, well, I'm a Christian. I don't suppose it would ever dawn on you to say, I'm a son of God. Why? Well, the neighbor might get shocked. Now, can you just think for a moment? You say, what? A son of God? Now, can you grasp the dignity of that? Can you understand you have a relationship that's not of this world at all? And you stand in the dignity of a son of God. Come on, square your shoulders and get your chin up. There's nobody like you. That's right. There's nobody like us. We're the sons of God. Wonderful, isn't it? That's relationship. That's character. Isn't that right? You'll meet someone. And they'll say, you don't need to tell me who that is. That's so-and-so's son. Isn't that right? I wonder if that... Wouldn't it be good if they could say that about you? You don't need to tell me. I can tell. You're a son of God. You're like your father. Now let's come back again to Exodus 1, please. So down into Egypt, now look at verse 7. Four things. The children of Israel were fruitful. One, increased abundantly. Two, multiplied. Three, were exceeding mighty. Four. Now you can appreciate this, can't you, that this is natural fruit. This is physical. This is the people of God numerically. And of course when you go over to the book of the Acts and you enter the new dispensation, you get the same thing. You find them multiplying. Now write 120, Acts 1. Acts 2, 3,000. Acts 4, verse 4, 5,000 men. Acts 5, multitudes of them. Right? Now first of all, they were fruitful. Now of course, obviously, in meetings like these, I want to give things a turn in order to apply them spiritually to us. Are we fruitful Christians? Now what does that mean? Well now, you go to John 15 and you'll read this. The Lord says, I am the true vine, and ye are the branches. Every branch in me that beareth fruit, he purgeth it that it might bring forth more fruit. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. Got it? Fruit, more fruit, much fruit. Now, what is fruit? What is fruit? Well now, fruit is the expression of the life of the tree. Isn't that right? Fruit is the expression of the life of the tree. Christ is the tree. To produce fruit is to express Christ. Isn't it? Now listen to what John 15 says. Look at that one. I am the vine and ye are the branches. Every branch in me that beareth fruit, that's positive. He purges it that it might bring more fruit. That's comparative. Once you produce fruit, now you produce more fruit. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same shall bring forth Much fruit, that's the superlative. Fruit is positive, more fruit is comparative, much fruit is superlative. Let me go back. So that when you're converted, you produce fruit and you begin to reproduce the life of Christ. Is that right? Now don't be too quick to answer. Listen. This world has only known two kinds of men. Adam and Christ. The first man and the second man, the natural and the spiritual. Which man are you reproducing? Come on now. For to me, to live, Christ! And that's what we're looking for in young converts. We're looking for Christ expressed in their life. Now, we are told that if you produce fruit, every branch in me that beareth fruit, he pruneth it, that it might produce more fruit. So that means in the passage of time you become more like Christ. And if you abide in him and he abides in you, the fullness of fellowship, you'll produce much fruit, the superlative. Now, am I right? Now, you folks, don't be afraid to tell me if you differ with me. Am I right? Fruit? More fruit? Much fruit. Does that mean this? That the youngest Christians are producing Christ? Those of us who have gone on a bit more, we are producing more of Christ. And the older saints are producing most of Christ. Is that right? Would you say amen to that? Now, don't you understand that this business of Christianity is all about Christ? It's all about Christ. Now, I shall be on the lookout along with you. 4 years since I've been here. Faith. Do you think you will see more of Christ in me than them? And I in you? Come on now. More of Christ. That's it. The church is a continuation of Christ. Now let's get down to the basic thing. Come on. Again. Look again. The increased abundance. That's the same word as in Genesis 1 verse 20. Let the waters bring forth abundantly, let the waters swarm with swarming. That's it. What is it? It's the whole, whenever you look around you, the whole place is swarming with life. That's it. Vital energy. You go to the Acts of the Apostles again, and there are thousands getting saved. Everywhere you look through a Christian, the place was swarming with spiritual life. They're just ordinary folks. But they were turning the world upside down. Look again. They multiplied. Multiplied. They waxed exceeding mighty. Now I could go on like this, but I don't want to stay in the gap all night. But you can see that the whole place is swarming with light. That's it. Now, who's now at their faith? That's the verse that governs the chapter in the book. There arose up a new king over Egypt that knew not Joseph. Therefore he didn't feel under any obligation to Joseph's descendants. And verses 9 to 14. He looks out over the land. And he notices that the children of Israel are growing stronger and stronger and stronger. So he calls a cabinet meeting. And he says to his counselors, now listen, let us deal wisely with these people. For if somebody invades us, if they turn with the enemy, we're finished. And he says, we'll need to deal with this. Now, you switch your eye over now to the spiritual realm. You'll understand this, that when God is blessing, there's somebody watching. Wherever you get the blessing of God, you'll get the activity of Satan. You read the Acts of the Apostles and you'll get the devices of Satan against the church at large.
You read the epistle to the Corinthians and you'll get the devices of Satan against the church local. Brothers and sisters, it's high time that we awoke to the fact that the devil's busy. All New Testament epistles were written against the background of trouble. We've got trouble from inside and we've got trouble from outside. Do you remember yesterday in the Bible reading? I drew your attention to the fact that a great deal of the source of trouble in local churches today is coming not only from carnal Christians. A lot of our trouble is coming from the fact that there are folks amongst us who are not converted. And more than that, you've got the devil constantly attacking us. And you can appreciate this. So here, you'll notice please, verses 9 to 14, he's attacking them from the outside. He set over taskmasters to afflict them. Verse 11, please. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities. Imagine. Imagine the sons of Israel beautifying Egypt. That's what Pharaoh's got them doing. He's got them building treasure cities to beautify the Egyptian system. Oh, the tragedy of this business. Of Christians being occupied trying to make this world a better place to live in. But it's getting worse all the time. See the danger. See energy deflected into wrong channels. Verse 12. But strange. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. That's right. You grind them down and they'll spring up. It was the same in the early days of the Acts. The more they persecuted them, the more the thing spread. Say, dare I say it? Could we do with a little of this? To purify our ranks and multiply our numbers? Over yonder, there's an underground church. Many of them can only meet secretly. They're being hounded and persecuted, and in their private prayer meetings, they're praying that the church of the West might get a little persecution to stir them up from the materialism. Makes you think, doesn't it? Say, we never had it to do. How little for God. Now, I want to talk to you now about this Egyptian system that was bringing them into bondage. Now, have you been taught these things? Now, once I mention them, you'll know whether you've been taught them or not. I'm talking now in relation to the world system. Have you been taught, please, the difference between the Sodom system, the Egyptian system, the Jericho system, and the Babylonian system? Now, you'll know now whether you've been taught them or not. The difference between the Sodom system, the Egyptian system, the Jericho system, and the Babylonian system. All various aspects of the world system that surrounds us. Now let me talk to you about them. The Sodom system is the world of filth and death and sex that's all around you. That you find in your glossy magazine, on the hoarding, that come over radio and TV. It's a whole world around you that worships the God of sex. That's the Sodom thing. Now the Jericho thing. You remember that when Israel entered the land, that Jericho straightly shut up its gates against them. So that Jericho is barring the way into the land. Now, Canaan is not heaven. You know that. Canaan is not heaven. Canaan was the place of the inheritance for Israel, where they fight their way in. So that Canaan represents the truth of God, enshrined in the scriptures for your enjoyment and mine. Now, are you enjoying the things of God? Now, have you? Now you see, the possibility is that the Jericho system standing, holding you back.
Now what is the Jericho system? Well, the Jericho system is this world controlled by evil spirits that's prepared to hinder you enjoying divine truth.
Now I'm back at the devil again.
When you go up to the epistle to the Ephesians and you read about all the wonderful truth of God, when you come to verse 12 of chapter 6, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the world rulers of this darkness. What does that mean?
It means this. That there are evil spirits opposing us on our way in to enjoy God's name. That's the Jericho system.
Now the Babylonian system.
The Babylonian system is religion without Christ and without the cross. That finds its center today in the World Council of Churches. And will find its apex in the Babylon of Revelation, chapter 17 and 18. All around you, you've got that system. Men teaching public places on platform and pulpit, supposedly to represent God and to deny every fundamental truth in the book. Do you remember at the conference on another aspect of this I taught you about Philistine principle? Here you have Babylon all around you. The vast system, and gradually they're dividing it. Ecumenicalism. And ultimately, by the time the church goes, it will be a vast amalgamation of everything that will ultimately prove to be anti-Christian. Babylon is not only Roman Catholicism, it's everything that's anti-God and anti-Christ. That's why in Revelation it says, come out of her, my people. And there are well-known evangelical figures that are even prepared to go along with it today. And they'll have on their platforms unconverted men and professors and ancestors. Now all that's making for Babylon. There's a lot of good men associated with sin that have never heard God say to them, come out of them, my people. Now the Egyptian system. Now the Egyptian system is quite complex. First of all, the Egyptian system stands for independence of God. Remember the book says, woe unto them that go down to Egypt for help. You see, Egypt was independent of heaven. Egypt was the Nile. They depend on the Nile to overflow its banks. Rain falls very seldom in Egypt. It falls away in the hills and is brought down by the river Nile. And they worship the Nile. It fertilizes the earth and overflows the banks. Egypt is independent of it. And we are out there. This world breeds independence of God. That's right. You go out and move amongst one way now. They're living without God. The only time you hear the name is in blasphemy. Independence of God. Very useful. Secondly, the Bible talks about the wisdom of Egypt. Moses was learned, instructed in all the wisdom of Egypt. That is the scientific culture and act of this world. Alright? Oh, the progress that's been made. Man's a wonderful creature, you know. Never do write him down. And don't write him off. Man's a wonderful creature. You know, when I consider sometimes there seems no height that can't change it. I can remember the time when it was impossible, they thought, to break the sound barrier. To go into space. Never.
Lunar space couldn't be done. Put a man in the moon. Impossible! Even the brethren said it. And they'll bring them right back. To within a few hundred yards. And men that have never been up there will tell you what the conditions are and get them safe too to meet the conditions that they're for.
Man's a wonderful creature.
Scientifically made advantage. Yet the Russian says, I never saw God up there.
Say, has it made America or Canada or Britain brought them any nearer to God? it furnishes men with an independent of God. Yet the same man can grovel in the dust and deny it. He's a complex being, man.
Come again.
The Bible talks about treasures in Egypt. That's the thing. We never had it to do. After all, there's nothing wrong with having money. The Bible never condemned it. But it does warn you that it takes a steady hand to hold the cup. But you look around you. In the mad race of the commercial world. The more you penetrate it, the deeper you'll become involved. Let me go back to the weekend again. You remember I indicated to you that the judgment seat, there will be no reward for being a successful businessman only. No reward for being a sales executive only. Nothing wrong with these things. But if it's choking your spirit of life and the devil's got you in your knees, then the treasures of Egypt are getting a grip.
Again,
the Bible talks about the pleasures of Egypt. It's pleasures. Very easy to come to them, isn't it? You young folks.
Very easy.
Say, be honest. And after all, there's no harm being honest in the presence of God. You're not answering me. I'm not wanting you to tell me. You can tell God. Would you rather watch the baseball on the television than come to the prayer meeting? Now, that will just put exactly where you stand. Would you rather go skiing at the weekend and attend the conference? Now, please, you make your own application. Because you'll understand this, that different aspects of the world would appeal to you more than what would appeal to me and vice versa. We're built different. But there are certain things. You see, what you're going for when you're alone in private will tell you where your weakness lies. What you turn to in privacy is where your weakness lies. So that the pleasures of this world in a time. Again, Egypt was a place of idolatry. All the plagues were against the gods of Egypt. Against all the gods of Egypt will I execute judgment, and all the judgments that God brought in, all these things, were all different gods in Egypt. And when God brought the plague in, he was defying the Egyptian God and overcoming it. It was a place of idolatry. Place of idolatry. Say, what's your God? Come on now. Silently in the secret sanctuary of your personality, at what altar do you bow? Can you see the danger of the Egyptian system? Vast, complex thing, isn't it? Now come again, please, will you? This time, you'll notice when you come to verses 15 to 21, 22, that the devil changes his tactics. He's not now attacking from outside, he's attacking from inside. That's always his way. If violence and threat won't accomplish it, then he'll move inside to undermine the people of God from the inside. Is that right? How did he break down Corinth? From the inside. He got the brethren at loggerheads, as he tells. He broke it down from the inside. Oh, how blind we are. How blind we are. Don't seem to realize how clever the devil is. And the same thing goes on all over and at Ecos time and again. Paul was a great man. He says, we are not ignorant of his devices. That's good. See, the devil can trip you up even in the name of truth. Now what? Verse 15.
So he gets a hold of the two midwives.
Now he says, look,
whenever you're doing your business,
if it's a son, kill him. If it's a daughter, let her live. Now you step back, please, and survey this in all its breadth. And you can see an attack immediately upon the seed of Israel to cut off the Messiah's side.
If you kill all the male children, the nation will die out and there'll be no Christ.
Isn't that right? Wasn't that true later on when he destroyed the seed's oil? And God intervened and saved one.
Come again. So that he issues his instructions. Now look at verse 17.
But the midwives feared God. You see, the devil's not omniscient. He's not omniscient. Now he was setting up his throne here in Egypt to attack.
And I know you're thinking that's a strange thing.
Well now, listen to this. Right into the chapter Tarjana, the Lord said, I know thy works and where thou dwellest, even where Satan's not to, even where Satan's throne is.
Now,
that means this. That the devil didn't dwell at Tarjana, but he set up an administrative throne at Tarjana to attack the church.
That's where his throne was.
Honest. He sets up an administrative throne. Is that the pretty interesting thing? Come on, guys. We're down to the fundamentals. He sets up his throne to attack the church. You see, you're dealing with spiritual things. It's high time we're instructed about these things. I mean, it's not easy talking about these things. How is it frightening?
Sunday night at this young folks meeting,
I was speaking to them. Speaking quite straight. Praying before them the claims of Christ, and I said to them, now I'm getting frightened. I said, for this reason. The last time I spoke like this, three engagements were broken. The devil might be after me shortly for this tonight.
Satan's throne.
And he's attacking. But he's not omniscient. It never struck him that the midwives would refuse to do what he said. The artist depicts the fear of his wild beasts. What could two women do against an autocratic monarch that had life and death in his hands? What could two women do?
Ah, but listen to me, will you? Women are more courageous than men.
The weakness of the vessel, but will magnify the power of God. Is that right? The weakness of the vessel will magnify the power. If two women will defy Pharaoh, that will prove that it's not them, it's God that's doing.
The midwives fear God. And the fear of God will hold you when your intelligence won't. You mark what I'm saying.
The path of testimony is strewn with shipwrecks of men and women that knew their Bible far better than ever you and I'll know it.
That's right. But if you can get your heart set in Christ, that will hold you. The midwives fear God.
There was a reverential awe of the eternal. And it came out in this, that they decided they would obey God rather than Pharaoh.
That's good.
Obey God rather than men. The midwives fear God. Listen to this. It's so sublimely simple. My, if we'd been writing this, we'd have written chapters about it. Just the same as I'm talking about it.
How does the Bible put it?
Oh, the prophecy of language. Concentrate. The midwives feared God and did not, as the king of Egypt commanded, that's all. And that was all they were doing. They weren't going to do it.
Well, just as simple as that.
The answer was, no.
Now, do you ever meet the devil?
I know you're beginning to think it's a bit of a strange voice, aren't you? So I ask you, Did you ever meet the devil? Do you believe in him? You say, don't be silly. Listen, do you believe in the devil? Do you believe in a personal devil? The Lord did, you know, and he met him.
I've met him.
I should take you to places where we've had it out. And we parted as we met, more than any. But he doesn't like me. And I don't like him. That is Luther. That is Luther. And they said, it says, they did not, as the king of Egypt commanded them. So the king of Egypt called them and he says, now, why are you not doing what you are told? They were facing death. He had the life in their hands. What could two women do? Now, here's what it says. Well, they gave the reason for it in verse 19. Told Pharaoh the reason for it. That was the end of it. Isn't it remarkable how God restrained Pharaoh? He accepted the explanation and that was that. You'd have thought he went into a rage, but God was overruling. Verse 20, therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed mighty. And it came to pass, verse 21, because the midwives feared God that he made them houses. That is, he built up the families. That's the idea of making houses in the Old Testament. He built up the families. He gave them children and built up their house. Not a little house, but their family. In other words, God blessed them from the stand. Now listen to this. The devil's convincing everybody that you're a loser by turning to God. Isn't that right? You go into the world. He'll tell you you're a loser by turning to God. The devil's convinced the world that you lose by turning to God. He's convinced lots of Christians that you'll lose if you're going to go out and out for Christ. He'll close certain doors. He might mean a certain sacrifice. Now let me go back to the conference again. Do you remember the appeal I sought to make to younger men? If need be, to do with a few hundred dollars a year less and do something for God. After all, the Lord's coming. The Lord's coming. The Lord's coming. And if he comes very shortly, what then? Only one life will soon be fast. Only what's done for Christ will last. And I tell you, it'll not sound very good at the judgment seat to say, well, you know, Lord, I was waiting till I got through my career, and I needed all my time, I hadn't time for the meetings, and I hadn't time to study, and really, I wanted to get to the top, and then, but it's too late, Christ has come. Now please, don't misunderstand me, there's nothing wrong with ambition, there's nothing wrong in getting to the top, if you're not sacrificing your spiritual life on the road through. Something. We want you to be something for God. And the secret is this, that the midwives fear. Now look at the last verse of the chapter. Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. Why, that's simple, isn't it? Eh? Why, that's very effective, isn't it? Listen again. Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, drown them. And every daughter save alive. But if you drown all the children, the male children, there's no seed to perpetuate Israel, and the nation will die out. Very effective, wasn't it? Just kill the male children. And it was in that background, and in those circumstances, that Moses was born. Why? This is the very time we would have chosen that he shouldn't be born. He wouldn't have fit into our story.
This is the worst time. For if Moses is born, he'll be drowned.
Shall I? But if he's God, believe that he won't.
But how will God do it?
Why, it's thrilling, isn't it?
How will God do it?
That'll be the story tomorrow, I think.
How God
does things.
You see, whenever things are a bit darkest, that's when God's going to break through.
Seriously.
When the storm clouds have gathered and the roar of the devil is here,
and into the world there comes a wee tiny sovereign infant, God knows. Still drowning in the Nile, don't you believe it?
Go!
Oh, for that. But you know how he did it? How he did it was wonderful.
How he did it was wonderful. Have you ever read Exodus 2?
It covers 80 years in Moses' life. So it's quite important. Now you'll read it before tomorrow night, won't you?
80 years in Moses' life. It'll take God from Exodus 3 to Deuteronomy 34 to tell you about the other 40. And it'll all start later on at the burning bush and over here.
I expect by Thursday night. Now you men listen to me. Moses lived till he was 120, isn't that right?
The burning bush began his great job of leading God's people.
He started his greatest business in life when he was 80 years of age.
Two-thirds of his life was God
when he started his greatest work for God.
Hey?
Man, the two-thirds of our life's gone, we're thinking about retiring.
We're thinking of getting out. We're opting out.
This man's beginning his greatest work for God.
For there is no substitute for maturity. There is no substitute for experience.
But there's a lot to go through before he reaches the burning bush. He's a lot of lessons to learn, and so have we before we reach our burning bush. And tomorrow night, if the good Lord spares us, and with those who gather together, we'll find out the ways of God to preserve the saints. And Sarah can roar as much as he wants. And he can give out all the edicts that he cares. If there's one thing sure in this world, it's this, that Moses won't drown. Moses can't drown. God will preserve him. I can look back in life. I can trace the hand of God in life before I was converted. And I wasn't converted until I was 19. And I wasn't reared in a Christian home. But I can trace the hand of God preserving, obviously having viewed something that I never knew existed. That's right. Never knew anything about them. Gospel Hall. A young Irish evangelist came to preach for a month. And the third week of that month I got converted. You know, quite distinctly. When the meeting finished and they went away, I walked down the road after the last meeting and I said to myself, I wonder what they're going to do up in that hall there now that the minister's gone. I thought the thing would come to an end. Yes, it did. I thought it was all built round the man on the platform. I hadn't a clue. If you had said to me in the road down that night to tell me you're converted, Jack, to tell me you're born again, Jack, I'd have said, sorry, I don't know what you're talking about. I wouldn't have had a clue. I didn't know the language. Listen, young folks. Have I told you? What I know God taught me. In the few years that followed that, when I'd go into the bedroom to read my Bible, I told you, didn't I? And the fire was good. I've got a big overcoat on me. 2 o'clock in the morning, Mother was coming, keep me off to bed. Oh, I didn't think I got very much. God knows that even yet, things come back to me, I must have read them. That's it. Of course, the Lord will. We'll continue with more.